Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. I have two guests today. One of the guests is Julie De La Terre. She holds an MS from the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's been an activist since she was a child, helping her mother care for injured wildlife. She owned a chemical-free landscaping business for almost two decades, which emphasized removing lawns and restoring native plants. As an environmental consultant, she assisted the Ho-Chunk Nation in efforts to design and implement a place-based ecological immersion project on their land near Black River Falls, with the intention of immersing young tribal members in nature while learning their language and culture. Recently, she assisted Ho-Chunk tribal member William Greendeer in introducing the rights of nature into the Ho-Chunk Constitution. She maintains her blog called Sacred Water, Sacred Land about the sacredness of all things, and also Heart of the Ho-Chunk with William Greendeer about Ho-Chunk culture and the environment. She's a professor of natural science at Viterbo University. William Greendeer is an elder of the Ho-Chunk Nation, whose territory recently spanned Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, and Iowa. He is Deer Clan and member of the Medicine Lodge. His first 8 summers were spent in a lodge, and he has a deep connection with the natural world. William experiences sacred connection with the natural world and offers prayer when harvesting a plant or animal. How to live in a good way on his land in southwest Wisconsin. He hopes to rejuvenate his old farm with native plants and also by protecting the beavers that make their home in his valley. I love beavers, by the way. His family's land and many of his tribal members' land have been affected by frack sand mining activities in addition to the damage caused by the cranberry growing industry in southwest Wisconsin. He introduced a Rights of Nature Amendment at General Council in September with 3/4 of the tribal members supporting it. He hopes that the rights of nature and tribal law will help the tribe protect their sacred land, water, and all our relations. So first, I would like to thank both of you for your work, and second, I would like to thank both of you for being on the program.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So the first question is, we mentioned frack sand and frack mining. Can you talk a little bit about what frack sand mining is and the harm it causes?
Well, first of all, the frack sand is actually used for the fracking process in drilling for oil and gas. And the sand itself is perfectly circular. So when they use high pressure and water and other chemicals, it separates the earth a little bit and the sand blows up into the cracks and then fracturing the earth, and then the gas and the oil flow down through the perfectly round beads of sand, and then they basically pump it back out. And we have been in Wisconsin here providing about 75% of the sand for fracking. And so they've ended up with a lot of huge holes all over the this side of the state. Just going, and they've been, I guess it started out with the cranberry, a lot of the cranberry bugs, because they actually at one point were trying to make cranberry beds, and it would become to be a big boom for a while with cranberries. And we actually, first part of the 1900s, were showing people how to harvest cranberries, and then it went really boom here in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I just I saw the cranberry marshes just pushing trees and plants and removing the animals and making great big piles out of the trees and just burning them. And seeing the animals displaced, the birds were just they didn't have nowhere to go to build their nest, a lot of big things. So it started into a snowball effect. So a lot of the cranberry growers partnered up with the sand mining when it was discovered more and more about the sand. Is when they move the topsoil, there's a lot of white sand, and that silica sand is what they're chasing after. And that the silica sand just, it went boom big time. We ended up having approximately about 160 mines in the last couple of years because of the fracking process. So they really, a lot of the companies that are doing sand mining are partnered up with the old cranberry beds and cranberry marshes. There are a lot of people that are actually working together with that. So the sand is really valuable, and that's what holds our water together. The sand really kind of does a lot for the earth. We actually, in our Ho-Chunk traditional religion, hold that white sand sacred. So they're actually messing with something that we really believe is a sacred altar, and they're just taking it and shipping it out near 21 Sears Towers worth of sand on a year. Now is a statistic from a couple of years ago.
And that's not all. It's not just the mines, which are exploding in number, but they're building out the railways. They're hauling this over the highways and destroying. Some of these roads have to be rebuilt every 8 weeks. And then the dust that blows off these huge sand piles is very harmful. It's as bad as asbestos, especially at sizes less than 2.5 microns. So there's a number of effects that these sand mines have on southwestern Wisconsin, and particularly on the lands held by the Ho-Chunk Nation tribal members.
So let's back up a second. First is, and I'm sorry for the ignorance, but are cranberries, when they're not grown in a farm, are they native or were they introduced?
Oh, they were native. They actually grew in the marshy areas. There was cranberries that were wild. The actual real cranberries were wild cranberries, and they started teaching people how to actually grab them, how to dry them, store them, that we could use them for all year round.
So there were native cranberries, but then what happens? You were talking about what is the conversion from a native cranberry bog to a cranberry farm? What is, you talked about that destruction. Let's talk about that for like another minute or two. What happens when you convert a cranberry bog to a cranberry farm?
Well, what happens is they kind of have a great time at plowing down the trees and making a what they call a cranberry bed. And what they do is they just level everything. Then that way they could put pumps in to flood the beds with to get the cranberries to float. They would actually have these beds. And years ago they had raking, what they called raking of the cranberries. Then they would put in boxes, and then they would use machinery to pick up the boxes and bring them out and sell them. Nowadays, they just corral the berries, they flood the marshes and the bogs, and just use an elevator and put them right in the trucks and take them right out to Ocean Spray.
So essentially, they monocultured the marsh, and all they grow is cranberries now, and they use a lot of herbicides and pesticides, just like many other modes of industrial agriculture.
And then through that was very popular, as you said, through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then when did the frack sand mining start to really kick in?
That started up about 5 years ago and really supported by the Scott Walker administration. And a great website to go for that is Wisconsin Watch. They've done a lot of work on how they got in here and how they have essentially no regulations to follow whatsoever. They opened the door and this industry just came in and just did whatever it wanted.
And you said that there's 160 of these in southwestern Wisconsin. And how big is the average? Well, and okay, when we say sand mining, I'm presuming that means open pit, right? So basically,
yep.
They scrape away everything, and it's just like everybody's picture of an open pit mine. And there's 160 of those. How big would be the average of those mines?
Well, I think that they vary in size. There's smaller mines, which is like there's one over right near two tribal lands. And right into our property where they had a pond that they had flooded. Basically, it is probably about a 20-acre square. There are some mines that are almost close to 1,000 acres. And they're actually talking about a mine up in Jackson County that's going to be close to 5,000 acres.
So 5,000 acres is like 7 or 8 square miles.
Yes. Yes, they're just taking everything. Uneman Mine in Tunnel City, Wisconsin, is they're talking about going down 7 stories into the earth.
So I'm going to ask a really stupid question, which is, what are the environmental effects of doing this? And the reason that's a stupid question is because, of course, open pits mining, open pits kill everything. So I don't even know what to ask because an open pit mining is so destructive.
Well, first of all, this sand is actually a sponge and it holds the water in southwestern Wisconsin and is actually the source of good water there. It's like a filtration system. So as they remove large volumes of this sand, they're actually changing the underground hydrology and people are experiencing changes in their well water, maybe no well water at all, maybe water where there wasn't water before and no water where there was water before, because this is all subterranean systems that we don't fully understand. And they're just digging it out and they don't know what the full effects are. Some of the other things I'd mentioned earlier is the silica dust. And Bill can speak to you about the tribal members have been complaining about all the other things that have been happening because his sisters and brothers are right next to these mines.
Well, one thing that even the elders really notice is amazing how the animals change. The habits of the birds are totally different now that are around the sand mines. And it would probably take an Indian to notice that the excrement from a bird is totally different nowadays from the birds that are around the mines. The animals, where I actually saw a wolf and two wolves and a mountain lion run from, that whole 40-acre field is now filled with a mine, and I'll never be able to see that again. There was actually some people that noticed some dead birds by a pond. Yeah, so we're seeing a lot of different changes, the elders especially.
So some of these processing facilities use up to 1 million gallons of water a day, and they use a chemical called polyacrylamide to flock out the dust so they get the nice pure sand. And then they take this water with this polyacrylamide and they stick it in these retention ponds, and that's where these people saw the dead birds. These ponds are not required to be lined because they say, well, enough clay will settle out to line it. So nobody's actually monitoring whether this stuff is getting into the groundwater supply. And polyacrylamide is an actual carcinogen. And some of these processing plants apply resin to the sand. Of course, in order to apply resin, you're going to use solvents. So these solvents are going out into the atmosphere. Essentially, they're industrializing southwestern Wisconsin. They turn it into a great big sand production facility. Some of the other effects are really heavy road traffic. Bill can talk about how his sister won't even travel on certain roads now, and some of the effects of these migrant workers coming in. Mostly local people aren't employed. It's people coming in from out of state. And then building out the rail lines, there's twice as many rail lines. And then the sand coming off the rail cars, the trucks, everywhere. And then when that sand comes off, you're putting dust into the air. Bill can talk about this loading facility in Toma that we filmed. Go ahead, tell them what you saw there.
I drove through there in Toma, Wisconsin, and they had a loading facility right in town within a mile of elder housing, grade schools, kindergarten areas, and the hospital. And this facility was just blowing sand everywhere. I walked up there and I tried to film and was chased off. There's the amazing amount of the hazards that are going down the interstate freeway with the semis that sometimes don't even have full tarps covering their loads. They should be covered with full tarp. And sounds like rain coming off your windshield if you're right behind one of these trucks. So it's just like asbestos. It's very dangerous, and it will affect a person that's been going back and forth on the freeways. My sister is afraid to even drive near her house she's like within miles of three mines. And these trucks have no real consideration about their size. So they end up, she doesn't even drive around the mines. So she actually makes like about a 7-mile drive to get into town just to get around the mines.
I think the most obvious thing is when you drive by one of these mines and these piles are huge. How tall do you think they are?
Oh, 3-4 stories high.
And you can see when the wind's blowing, you can see all the dust blowing off of these piles. And you can really see it at night because these mines are all lit up because they're industrial sites. and you can see the dust in the air. You can see the light reflecting off the dust, and it's a haze. And like Bill said, this is like asbestos. People are breathing that all wherever these sand mines are. And the ultra fine particles can blow as much as 100 miles away. So I'm in West Lima. I'm probably getting dust from Toma, which is about 40 miles from where I live.
So this all makes me think of the worst industrial, by number of deaths, the worst industrial disaster in the United States history, which was the Hawk's Nest Tunnel in West Virginia. And they built this tunnel through an area that was very high in silica, and a huge number, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but a huge number of the workers there died of silicosis. So can we talk about the health hazards of silicosis from the silica?
Can I talk about Crispin Pierce? Is he from University of Eau Claire?
Yes.
Yeah, Dr. Crispin Pierce has been studying this. He's from the University of Eau Claire. And there's a number of health people in Wisconsin who are taking a look at this. And he puts out dust monitors and is just finding dust all around these mines. And a lot of people will have like a film of dust right in their homes. And so far, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is not making sure that these mines keep this dust from flying around. That's the problem. There's really no requirements.
The DNR is just the permit company. They don't really monitor or really the air quality or the water quality has really been really poor in a lot of the areas around here, Wisconsin, because of the Scott Walker administration. He's actually cut back on the DNR too, and so there's the whole deal with the silica that's really happening. You know, if this is just the same as asbestos, people are going to really start getting sick in 20, 30 years from now.
Or even less.
People that have no idea just how serious asbestos is. And if it's just like that, the silicosis is going to be awful. I mean, you end up with heart problems. You end up breathing short. There was one truck driver that actually got hold of us, and he's like, he got sick up here in Wisconsin, and they drove his truck back for him into Texas. And basically, what happened is he had a hard time breathing. And in his 40s, driving a truck, and he can't work anymore. He's got a family to support, so he didn't want his name out there. But he actually got sick from driving the silica around, as far as I know. And yeah, that's what he was trying to talk to me about.
So we wonder whether they hire out-of-state employees just so that there's no record here of people getting sick from the dust.
Well, that's actually really interesting, too, because that was exactly what happened with the Hawk's Nest Tunnel back 100 years ago. They hired especially African-Americans, poor African-Americans from all over the country in great measure, so that when they died, nobody would know. So it's one of those, the more things change, the more they stay the same. There's another question I want to ask, too, which has to do with the sort of right-wing notion of takings and how that's always used simply to promote industry. That the reason I bring this up is because I'm thinking that if it's lit and if it's loud, I mean, I love where I live here in Second Growth Forest in Northern California, and if somebody put in a mine a half mile away or a mile away, I would stay here because I love this land, but I would want to move because it would destroy everything with the lights and the noise and the destruction to wildlife. So what is it like to live around these?
It's amazing that what I really noticed was, first of all, when they come in, they don't really talk about anything, what they're doing. All of a sudden, you start seeing loads of earth movers just getting dropped off, and then they start driving into a field, and you're like, wow, I wonder what they're going to build, a house or a subdivision. And all of a sudden, they start knocking down the trees and just amazing piles, and then they start burning it. So it's like, what a waste of tree life. You know, I mean, the life that supports us is being just knocked down and burned. And I really noticed that when I was growing up, just with the cranberry marshes. And the cranberry marshes, they don't care for beavers. They don't care for muskrats. They're shooting them, the beavers and the muskrats, and just leaving them laying on the banks because they damming up their waterways, and they don't want that. And so it was like seeing life just getting knocked down, you know, from the word go, it seems like. The whole deal with the mines that just came in, now we're, I enjoyed living in the woods and grew up out in Weigel, Wisconsin. There was never anything really making any noise when I first grew up there. I loved to hear the wind. I loved to hear the trees. Now, you know, even growing up just after high school, you'd go out there and you'd hear these motors, these pumps, pumping water all night long because they're worried about their cranberries. And so now there's noise pollution. Then all of a sudden, sand mines moved in, and all of a sudden you're seeing structures that are 2-3 stories tall, 4 stories tall, and just nothing but lights, nothing but light setup. So there's no day, no nighttime. You can actually look like a small city just over the trees. And right now there's 4 mines just within 10 miles over the house I grew up in. So they look like little cities, just amazing.
And not only is that where he grew up, but that's a ceremonial ground. And in their belief system, having good darkness is part of how they experience the world. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah. One of our major things that we have when we're growing up, and I don't ever hear really a lot of other people talk about it, is, you know, you pray before you go to bed. And what we used to do is we were taught to pray for daylight. And people don't do that. You know, you're thankful that you wake up, but nobody ever really prays for daylight. And that's a part of life was to go into the darkness and let the spirits move around. When with all these lights and everything, the spirits have a hard time moving around too. And it disrupts the whole way of living when all of a sudden you've got machines going all night long. And, you know, it's something that you don't get used to. It feels like a prison. You know, you've always got alarms going off. You've always got lights that are shining everywhere. The trucks are, I used to actually went north and thought I was going to go into a wooded area and enjoy hearing the sounds of the frogs. I wanted to go hear the wild frogs. And I went out there, and all I could hear was trucks jake breaking, where they were actually getting ready to turn into a mine. And it was a steady flow of trucks. So it was like, wow, what I used to enjoy miles out in the middle of nowhere, now there's just semis, one after another. Just amazing amount of sound, light, and it's nothing like it used to be when I was growing up.
So let's talk about the Ho-Chunk Nation for a while. And you said your lands originally covered parts of several states. So how much land did you have before? How much land do you have now? And what is the relationship? But how much land are you recognized by the government as having, and how much, and what is the relationship between these mines and the Ho-Chunk lands?
Okay, first of all, like I said, there's Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, and we actually just we went up about halfway up the state of Wisconsin, and went all the way down to just like northern Chicago, and just in the west end of Wisconsin, eastern Iowa, Minnesota, and it was a pretty good area. We end up now with, in order to make our agreements with the United States government, we ended up with 40-acre parcels, mostly 20, 40, 60-acre parcels. And you had to buy it. They didn't tell you about taxes. And so when they wanted to take your land, they basically said, hey, you haven't paid taxes. And then it was something that we wasn't used to either. even later on when they came to the point of we have probably between five and 6,000 tribal members, and not every family has a living area, but we do not have a reservation. So that's the other thing, is our tribal lands are basically separated, small, and spread out, and we're having to buy our own lands back.
And so, when you say we're having to buy our own lands back, are they being bought individually or collectively as a nation?
Both. Amazing that we actually, you know, had to come back, and actually my place is part of an area that in the Driftless area that was taken away from us by the treaties, so that way they could mine lead back then. So it's actually having to buy your own land back, and it's like you hear all these strange names like retreat and red mounds because of the killing of the natives there, and it was just all red with blood. It's like you hear all these different stories about what really happened back then, and nobody wants to talk about that.
And not only were they having to buy their land, the government told them that they had to farm it. They couldn't just have their land and be on it how they wanted to. They had to follow all these stipulations on top of it.
Yeah, we were actually given the land to basically farm. We had to become farmers or we couldn't really have the land. They would not let us live with traditional foods. We had to pick up what we call nowadays commodities. A lot of Indians, if you talk about commodities, every Indian pretty much knows about commodities, and that was something that we had to live with, and we could not go out and harvest. We could not use our language, or we didn't even get our religion back legally until 1978, you know, Freedom of Religion Act. So there's a lot of whole things there. Right now, what I'm trying to do is teach a lot of native foods and a lot of not so much medicinal plants, but we have a knowledge of a lot of medicinal plants. But it's more like how to live on the earth and be okay with the foods. So that's a big thing right there.
So let's talk about that just a little bit more. That traditionally. What were some of the primary foods and relationships with non-humans that the Ho-Chunk would have? I mean, I know that there were a lot of passenger pigeons in that area. Is that something you ate, or did you eat? Whom and what did you eat?
Well, most of it was wild foods. Amazing that, you hear so much about the monarch plant. I don't like the word weeds, so I call them, they're actually the non-natives. They have never really been close to the earth, as far as I know, and they would call it milkweed, and the monarchs, they love that. So I prefer to call them the monarch plant instead of milkweed, and that was very nutritious as far as a staple for Ho-Chunk people. Along with other plants that were out there, and you know, wild potatoes, there was berries. There were so many berries. Aronia actually was another staple. Cranberries. There was quite a few different amounts of food out there that were just edibles. And there was actually animals that we did not touch, that we did not eat, but there was some that we did. And you know, like my favorite food is actually muskrat. To me, that's a delicacy. Not even young people eat much of it these days, but there are quite a few that actually do get out there and provide food like that for the elders.
And so when you don't have a collective, a collectively owned land, like I live, where I live is on Talawa, T-O-L-O-W-A land, and the Talawa have they're called rancheria out in California. They have a collectively owned land as well as the individuals owning land off the rancheria. How does that work for your land use discussions when you don't have a collectively owned land?
Our tribe is sovereign nature, which means that we're basically on our own. So a lot of times we do have our own government. And when it comes to the rights of nature, that was one of the reasons that I figured that we could probably try to have this into our constitution. Our relationship with the earth was very close, and everything was sacred. A lot of people would say, all my relations. We have a similar way of saying it, and I really believe that we needed to get something going to be able to go a step back. And look, we were told we had to have a constitution in order to be sovereign. Well, part of that was not including the whole deal with the ecosystems. You know, the ecosystems were part of us, and a lot of us. And we basically, we wanted them to flourish and exist just the way that they were out there, not be pushed into a pile, not be pushed to be burned. And, you know, we had these ecosystems that supported us, and we supported them. When we harvested a plant or a food plant or a medicinal plant, we had prayer, we had a song that we sang, and then we actually, a lot of times, actually put the stems back into the earth so that way they would come back. There was a whole relationship that basically the non-natives did not have. We weren't owners of the land. We were just the whole part of it. We didn't want to basically be owning land. The land belonged to everybody. Even nowadays, I talk that we are all in this thing together, that we all should be working together, and that we all have relations out there, the trees, the water, the air, and that we have to take care of it.
That, of course, makes perfect sense. And I'm wondering how are you as a people opposing, how are you collectively and individually opposing the frac sand mining? First off, is it fairly unanimous among the nation that the opposition to frac sand mining? And second, what are both the Ho-Chunk people and the other people who live there doing to try to stop the frac sand mining?
Oh, we're all kind of getting together. I like that. Right now, the Ho-Chunk Nation, I don't know anybody that really wants the frac sand mining to be happening. The ones that I really want to happen is the cranberry growers that are in cahoots with the mining companies, Preferred Sand, High Crush, you know, and these are the folks that are, they're so like into the whole money thing, putting the money in their pockets. Well, they're not going to be able to eat that money, but, they really just want to be able to just keep making more and keep taking away. The whole thing about the land being and the sand being taken is it's going to be messing everybody else up around them. But we, as a people all together, are really working together to get it going.
So there's been some collaborations between tribal members and non-tribal members and trying to actually prevent frac sand mining by writing ordinances with help from the Citizens Environmental Legal Defense Fund. But Bill wanted to take it a step further and put the rights of nature right into the Ho-Chunk Constitution, which had given more teeth so that they could actually try to stop a proposed mine or pass a law and not even happen in a certain area. But the mines have been here only about 5 years, and it's hard for communities to rally and make big changes within regulatory processes and laws to respond because they came in so fast. And of course, the industry knows that the faster they can come in and exploit a resource, the less we're prepared to fight them off, because they've got the expensive lawyers that can slow everything down in court. And by the time we get some kind of settlement, they're already gone and they left the holes in the ground.
Yeah, I guess that's the whole thing too, is they're smart enough to be able to go, and a lot of the people that actually exist that are working the mines, they're the ones that part of the village town board, village boards and the town boards, and they change the ordinances so that way they can have a mine put in real quick. And like, man, a lot of times you have no idea a mine is actually coming in until you see all the trees get knocked down.
So you'll have an entire community not wanting a mine to come in. You'll have three representatives in collusion with the mine owners, and they'll let it come in anyway, even though the majority of the citizens don't want it.
Hey, that's how democracy works, isn't it?
Oh, it's not supposed to be like that, Derek. Come on.
that's American as apple pie right there.
Oh, yeah.
So I want to just do some math here. You basically have said this is 5 years, and I mean, it's been going on for 5 years on this, and 160 mines in 5 years. That's more than 30 mines a year. That's more than a mine every 2 weeks.
Isn't that insane?
That's nuts.
It is nuts.
It is, really. And, you know, I guess the thing of it is you have no idea when they're going to move in, because they a lot of times they have gag orders, and you can't really talk about who bought your land. And like one guy I talked to, he had no idea that the same mine had bought next 10 people of his neighbors off. And nobody knew about it until all of a sudden, then all of a sudden, you, next thing you know, you've got seven stories in the earth and you've got 1,000 acres in a circle.
Not only that, when the land is being bought, they're not calling themselves a mine. You don't know they're a mine until they actually get all the land, and all of a sudden it's a mining company. But yeah, Before that, it's a property company.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing is a lot of times they won't even say anything. Up in Jackson County, Wisconsin, the Ho-Chunk Nation actually has their tribal offices there. They had actually been transporting sand, and they were supposed to be just one unit to be digging out gravel. And they were driving down tribal land, tribal roads, and they never even once talked to the Ho-Chunk Nation about what they were doing. So also we found out they were driving dump trucks of frac sand out, and was like, this is a new one on us. And we had actually talked to a board member in the town of Brockway, and she was saying she had no idea that they were actually selling frac sand out there. And I believe in second in command of Milestone Materials, he actually said, yes, well, yeah, we have been selling some sand out there. And then so they basically shot themselves on the foot. They didn't even realize that they were telling people that, they were selling frac sand without even having a permit.
As you're saying all this, I keep picturing, you know, this land where I live and I love so much. If suddenly there was a frac sand mine went in next door, I am not prone to panic attacks, but just thinking about that, I'm feeling very panicky and heartbroken. I don't know what I would do if they put in something like that next door. I would be completely devastated. And I think that anybody listening to this, if they live in anything other than an apartment in the middle of a city that is next to a freeway, would feel the same thing. This is just dreadful.
One thing that really motivated me to actually try to turn in this resolution to the nation was, we have tribal lands that we do ceremonies on. There's an outfit out of Tomah, Wisconsin that actually was building a mine, and their tailings pond breached, and it flooded into our tribal ceremonial grounds on the back of our property and right next to the tribal lands of another family. And To go back there now, there's white sand out there in the woods that were just beautiful. You see ducks and deer, rabbits, squirrels, everything, and now there's nothing out there, which is pretty heartbreaking. It made me mad at first, and then it just made me sad because you see such destruction that's going on. There's 20 earth movers out there now. You know, so you wonder how bad they're going to keep just destroying the stuff that is so sacred, you know.
And then you wonder the effects of all this on the non-humans, because all that sound and light and everything else, I mean, what are they supposed to do about it?
Yeah. So you mentioned the rights of nature a couple times being put into the constitution of the nation. And what do you mean by that? And what effects do you hope that will have on what happens to the real physical world?
Okay, first of all, the I guess the non-humans are the non-humans never really had rights when the Constitution came in, and a lot of the non-natives came in, the miners, they looked at nature as property. And they could do whatever they wanted. And with the rights of nature, you have a rights of ecosystems to flourish and exist. And it gives a citizens authority to petition on behalf of the ecosystems when you have the rights of nature. You want to be able to stand up in court. And they've used it in a couple of other countries. As far as I know, where the Ho-Chunk Nation is the first in the United States to adopt or try to put something like this into our constitution. I don't know of any other tribe that's done it so far. And the ones that don't have it, they're just going nuts and really believing that this is my property. I can do whatever I want. But they don't realize that if they're doing something that that's destructive, and it happens to their neighbor, excavation company in Tolma that ran all its the pond into our tribal lands, it's affecting us. And this year would give us the trees or that marsh. We'd be able to defend them and give them legal standing in the court system. That way we would be able to stand up as the trees and as the marsh out there, and be able to say, you heard us. And the government would have to actually be the agencies would be required to remedy the violations of these rights.
So what do you see? Okay, first, I guess, with the collapse of the oil price, has that helped slow down the influx of mines at all?
Well, what's happening, Derek, is they're stockpiling the sand because they know that the market's volatile, and they figure the price of oil is going to pick up anyway. So we've seen very little slowing in activity, maybe one shutting down here or there. But for the most part, they're doing the stockpiling thing because they're confident that fracking is going to continue globally. In fact, it is. Our frac sand goes all over the world and to destroy environments everywhere.
So we have probably 4 or 5 minutes left. And one question is, what can anybody listening to this, what do you want somebody who lives in that region, what can they do to help? And what can somebody who does not live in that region do to help? I guess that's the first two questions.
Well, first of all, I'd urge other tribal entities, the Menominees, the Chippewas, and actually have them install the resolution of the rights of nature and be able to stand up against these people that are the corporations. Because what it does is it actually takes away their rights. to actually exist and to do damage to other tribal ceremonial grounds. It would help the Bad River people up north to stop this Gogebic mine up there and help save our wild rice that we actually trade our things and our corn with and our tobacco with them. You know, we've always had a trade system, bartering system that depended on the things that they had, and we did the same thing with they did the same thing with us.
And also, people could look up the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature and the Citizens Environmental Legal Defense Fund, because these two organizations are working to change laws, to change the way that we look at nature and interact with nature, and understand that there is no economy without an ecology. And in fact, as we destroy the natural world, we're actually destroying ourselves. So our laws need to change in a big way.
And are there, we've got like 2 minutes left, and are there other questions that you wish I would have asked you? Are there things you've wanted to say that I haven't given you the opportunity?
Well, I think that one of the things that we have out there is to calm down some of these corn farmers. Those high tower, high power transmission lines. We have to start looking at all the whole thing, the whole picture. We have to start keep looking at the ethanol plants that are, I mean, we have wind towers, but all of a sudden these ethanol plants are popping up everywhere.
So I guess what Bill's saying is look at the entire system. He's right. There's high power transmission lines running all over the place to supply the frac sand mines and of course the ethanol plants. So there's layers of extraction going on to feed our endless desire for cheap power and cheap fuel, not just in the U.S., but globally. So maybe talking about or thinking about how can we live on the earth a lot more reasonably.
And also another thing is to learn what you have in your environment. What kind of foods do you have? Like I was talking about the monarch plant. There are so many coffees out there. There's teas out there. There's medicinal plants out there that people have no idea about.
So it would give you a deeper appreciation for your own local regional ecologies.
Well, I could not agree more with everything you're both saying. And I would like to thank you so much for your work and for being on the program. And I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Julie de la Terre and William Greendeer. This is Jarek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.